Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, I'm Sam, and on the podcast today, we have Rob Wilson. Now, that is a name you've probably not heard of, but if you hang around in the motorsport scene long enough, you will definitely come across him. He is the driver coach for the stars, Formula One drivers. He's had something like 70 Formula One drivers, WEC and all of the rest. And he's the person that if you're a multiple winning champion or you're not just nearly there in F1, you give him a call and he will come and hone your technique, which kind of sounds kind of crazy in itself, doesn't it, really? But we have a good chat about all of this, so enjoy.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about, sort of short summary of who you are and what you do?
Well, these days, probably in the last 30, since the end of the 1980s, really, I train racing drivers. I raced cars for close on 40 years from the early 70s through to about 10 or 12 years ago. Nothing too grand, but just made a living doing
it. Yeah.
And, but concurrently, towards the end of the 1980s, we started training racing drivers, which was different to racing school stuff. So in the 70s, you would instruct at racing schools,
okay.
Thruxton and things like that. But that's different. It was a matter of starting realizing that drivers, even though they're on the cusp of Formula One, winning in Formula Three and such like, where people assumed they were light bulbs, you know, you just plug them in and they're
crazy. Yeah, yeah.
And I would test some of those cars, even though I wasn't racing Formula Three by then. And you'd go a little bit quicker than some of them. And you would notice something about their driving and think, you know, are we not getting on the throttle a bit too soon here? Are we not rushing into the corners a little bit too much? This would be while you're watching them at testing at Silverstone or something. And so we'd try one or two little things that go a bit faster. And that's what triggered the driver training thing. So let's get a road car and get a good word and sit there with them. I'll do a couple of laps, sit beside them. And then say, there's a little bit of time missing here. What is it? And it began with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see, yeah, it's the way you turn the wheel, the way you go on the brakes, the way you decrease the brakes. It became, a bit of an obsession to do that.
And okay, so let's sort of wind back a little bit. How did you get into racing?
Oh, well, I was born in New Zealand, but I decided I wanted to start in England. Because I didn't want to do well in New Zealand to start with, and then find you arrive in England, and you're 21st or something.
Yeah,
I wanted to find out where you, because I'd watched the Tasman series, which was great in New Zealand. But the what we call the international drivers who come out, or even New Zealanders that had spent some years in Europe, would come out and they would just be so much Case Harden, Bruce McLaren, Chris Amon, Denny Holm, these people. And whereas those who had stayed in New Zealand, you know, were going more for New Zealand titles, and there was a difference. So I thought, so I saved up the money, got on an airplane. It's got to be 50 years ago, and dropped into Heathrow. And then you thought, well, how do you start? So that took a couple of years because I thought, well, you know, you did need to earn money or do something. And so nothing much was happening except an advertisement cropped up in Autosport magazine for you'd win a prize, half a dozen Formula Ford races, if you won this contest at Goodwood, which is about 500 people turned up over about 6 months and driving Formula Fords. And I won that.
Oh,
and,
nice.
And Derek Bell was an instructor, plus David Purley, who was a cohort of Derek Bell's, very good driver, and passed away in an airplane incident. But they were good drivers, and they were the instructors down there. And so I won this, got half a dozen Formula Ford races.
Nice.
And then a friend from New Zealand was over and said, why don't we get a Formula Ford and we'll take it back and do the New Zealand series.
Yeah.
This end of 75. So I did that. Went okay. Came second in the championship. Came back to England. More Formula Ford. And then it just, it did okay. And it jumped into Formula Ford 2000, which is the next one up. And that went okay and got a win or two. And then into Formula 3. And I got a win or two there. And, it was okay. But it was all fairly threadbare, but we could still, still did okay.
And were you having to, how did you get the drive? Like when you move up to like Formula 3, did a team approach you previously and then were like, come drive for us? Or how?
Yeah, well, there was, I fell into some sponsorship. It wasn't a lot, but there was a New Zealander called Sir Tom Clark who used to back the America's Cup efforts from New Zealand. He was a great racing driver back in the 50s, and he had backed a couple of New Zealanders coming over here. So he put a few thousand pounds into it. And then a computer company called ICL along the road here, we're near Putney, they were based there. And they came along with some marketing budget. So we got about £15,000 together. And then I'd talk to Ron Turanak, who had designed the Brabhams that won the World Championship for Jack Brabham and Denny Holm, but had formed a company called RALT, R-A-L-T, down in Woking. So I would go down there. He supplied a chassis. You could have got deals from everyone. You know, in those days, I need brake pads from here, so we put a sticker there. And we need fuel from there and bits and pieces. So we got this deal together. Still came fourth in the British Formula 3 Championship with Nelson Piquet second. And you could do it with a bunch of Kiwis and people helping out and so on. So we were on an economy class ticket, but we got some proper results. And I
ended
up with my super license of Formula 1. I won some races or two, And we would get cash from winning a European Championship race. They got the money. You'd finish the race and you'd go, and it would be the FIA F3, and they would give you cash at the signing on counter.
Nice.
Well, if you won or came second or third. And BP would sponsor it, and you'd get, I think, something like £5 or £10 a lap that you led. So the one to lead was at Mallory Park, because it'd be like a 50-lap race. And these things kept it going, And now people, they need millions. To even do it. But we just did it. We learned our craft because you'd be rolling around. Rory Byrne was building Royals. He was around helping. And he's still very senior at Ferrari as a designer in charge of things. And Patrick Head was building Ford 2000s, Deltas.
Yeah.
So he'd been there. Adrian Rayner. People who were learning their craft. A lot of that stuff doesn't exist anymore because they were designers learning to be designers and engineers learning to be engineers. And it wasn't a one-make series like everything's a Dallara now or a Miguel or something.
300 people on a team.
That's right, yeah. But, you know, you sat there thinking, I wonder if we did this, if we did that, if we did the other, and you know, occasionally wings would fall off. And yeah, but you learned. And a lot of those people were still running motor racing later on.
Yeah.
You know, they're still senior people. I mean, they're all passing away now and stopping, but it was a golden period for engineers and drivers and, you know. And you were always, people talk about these accidents they have now, you were always relieved on Monday night to be watching Coronation Street on TV because you knew you'd survived the weekend. You know, you were there. It really was a real thing.
What was the, was there like a particular car that you were like, that was really hairy to drive? Or was it more of like, it just is because they're all a bit sketchy?
Oh, there were some frightening cars. This one, I was trying to qualify at Indy probably 30 years ago, and it vibrated so much that you come out of turn four to see the guy with the flag, and you couldn't see him by the time you got there because the vibrations were so much that the helmet was twisting to the left. It was like, and you had to slow down for turn one, which you sort of had to anyway because they're quite powerful. They didn't handle very well. In order to see what you call an apex, it was, and you're lapping at 36 seconds, 2.5 miles, and it stepped out of line at one point, and I got away with it. You know, you'd never really normally get away with it. That was a worrying car, and it broke down during qualifying on the fourth lap. It was going fast enough to be in the field, and AJ Foyt was there, he was in the garage next. He was been there for a few weeks. He said that saved your life. That car breaking down saved your life. So that was a very frightening car. They then gave me a drive in his car on what they call Carburation Wednesday there. And it was suddenly, it was like 8 mile an hour quicker. It was instead of lapping at 218 and frightening the life out of you, it would lap at 225 and it was...
stable.
It was so good, yeah. And so that car was a bit of a worry. But that was because it had a fault, not because an Indy car... You know, can't be really nice.
Yeah.
Or an oval can't be really nice. So, no, but most of the cars were, you know, experimental. We went through the phase of everything was treaded tyres and then wings turned up and then ground effect turned up and skirts with ground effects.
Quite a transition.
And it, so we pretty much went through all of it as it was developing. And cars became better. Drive, they didn't break down quite as much. They did still quite a bit. I never left the pits on these Bathurst 12 hours or the Nürburgring 24 hours without my mobile phone, I suppose I should leave it there, and without a packet of cigarettes. Yeah, because you could be in the wilds of somewhere at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
No soul in sight. So it was always good to have the cigarettes and the phone because if the car broke down, sometimes there'd be electrics.
Yeah.
You couldn't radio the pits.
What's it like driving an oval at those sorts of speeds?
If the car's good, it's nice. But by and large, there's always something. More tough. I did this thing called Busch Grand National, which is Division 2 in NASCAR. I mean, Pontiac or Ford Thunderbird. Or a Chevy Monte Carlo, and I did a lot of those, and a lot of the what they'd call the Winston Cup drivers would do it as well. So there'd be two divisions, but the big guys would also do the next level now.
Okay, yeah.
And that was tough because qualifying would be one lap or two laps at the most, and these guys have been driving around at these tracks since they're 13, in the world of outlaws and this, that, and the other. And so you'd get one lap. The qualifying was the tough lap because you would do about a 15-minute session on the morning and that would be done by about 9:30. Then all the cars would be lined, angle-parked in the pits on the oval. And then it's your turn to qualify, and each car qualifies independently. The number is taken out of a hat.
Okay.
So I think it might still be your number 7, your number 31. Yeah. And that car is sat there. It's frozen cold, because it's sat there since, you know, whenever it is.
Yeah.
And then you leave the pits on brand new tires, and they are hard tires because you're going to go a couple hundred miles before you change them. So they're not like qualifying tires. So they're made out of concrete. And then around you go, you miss turn one because you're coming out of the pits. And then you turn two over the back. And you change from third to fourth going down the back straight. This is leading up to your qualifying lap. And it'll wheel spin still when you're going from third to fourth. And then this would be on a circuit that you had to brake for, say, 1 mile over. And so you're doing about 165 in this 2-ton thing that's like driving the spare room. And then you would have to brake for the corner. The first time you touch the brakes, and you go flat out. And of course, the brakes are cold. So you're never quite sure, but it slows down. You got to turn the car, and then you got to be on the throttle, and the exit's way over there somewhere. And it's either understeering a bit, or it's oversteering a bit, it's neutral, or something. But you can't see the exit, and your foot's hard down, and you're going to exit that corner with more revs on the clock than you're going to do for the rest of the weekend because you're on your brand new tires. And that's one lap out there. And then, boof, you start your lap, and it's done. And 25 seconds later, it's over. And there would be, and when I was doing it, there was something like 65 cars going for 32 spaces. So it was so easy to qualify like 22nd, 24th. In the race, I get going, I'll be all right. You know, you get settled in, and every time, a few races, and you make the top, you get into, say, after about 100 miles, you're 10th, you know? You make the top 10. And I did that a couple of times. And as soon as you did it, I get black flagged. And my friends, who are good friends, and still are, who would be running the car, say, don't say anything. They're just testing your temperament. And there was this time at Nazareth in Pennsylvania. It's an oval. And sure enough, I get into 10th place, and flag. And it's not a big oval. It's just under a mile, you know. So in there, under a green, NASCAR official comes up. I'm looking through the netting. Says to the crew chief, seems to be a bit of smoke coming out of the car. You know, okay. So, well, it wasn't, of course. Can you lift the hood? You know, so up goes the hood. Still under green, and cars are going by. And I can see him looking around under the thing there and looking a bit more. Comes back out. Seems all right. Actually, seems all right. Yeah, I think you're all right. Down goes the thing, and off you go. You know, four laps down. You know, with another 150 miles to go. And after the race, the first time it happened a couple of times. This NASCAR official came up and said, "You all right, Rob?" I said, "Yeah. You're learning how NASCAR works, and learning a lot." Yeah, there you go. That's good. And I've been told, don't say anything, you know, because they're just, and so. And the prize giving that year, so this would be sometime in the earliest mid-90s, was in New York City. And my friends who were behind me, who were also part of the NASCAR setup, heard a couple of NASCAR officials talking on the other, one side of the room, going, hey, you know, how's that English guy? Because they wouldn't even know where New Zealand was. You know, this is way before any internet or anything like that. And English, another guy said, nicest guy you could meet. And then came back and said, you're in. It's okay. They like you, you know. But if they don't like you, they'll send you home.
That's mental.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's their show. You know, it's their show. A lot of people make lots of money. It's their show. And I look back at it with great affection. You know, I got on good with them. We're still friends with some of them. You know, the crew chief on my car, we were down in the Carolinas about to go to Rockingham. And the Rockingham that they've got in America. It's an oval, mile oval. Jim Clark raced there, and back in 60-something, he did a NASCAR. And he's setting it up. And this is way before there was any internet. People, you know, you learn what you learn from occasional newspaper columns or something.
Yeah.
And he's doing the brain. He says, you know, Rob, in NASCAR, if you're from the north, you're from the north. If you're from the south, you're from the south. If you're from California, well, you ain't really from anywhere. you ain't even from California. I said, I guess you're... He said, I guess you're racing there because they don't really have that much racing in Europe, do they? You know? I go, not like they got there. And but it was brutal. It was so competitive. Because I'd go to the Rockingham and I forget what lap times was, but there was some superstar guys, a guy called Mark Martin, who was Ford number one, big Ford champion, NASCAR champion, doing the Busch race as well. And I'm running around running about the same sort of time as him in Tesla. And I said, pretend it was a 25-second lap. You know, so I'm going like 25-2 or something.
Yeah.
So I said to the guys in the team after that, what's pole position going to be for this race? I said, probably 24-9. Okay. So what's the middle going to be? They said, maybe 25-1. I said, no, not the middle of the front row, the middle of the pack. That'll be the middle of the pack. So what's last going to be? You know, maybe 25-6. You realize it's tough. And you're going to try and get this together in one lap, or maybe sometimes you get two, but usually it was one. It was the toughest form of racing that for everything I'd done that I'd ever done. But I'm so glad I did it. I do like about half a dozen races a year for about 4 or 5 years. I couldn't live in America. I was doing stuff over here, so I had to come back out again. But I still look back on it with fantastic affection. And you see some of them do well. Some of them find it tough. You know, watching Shane Van Gisbergen, he won the NASCAR race the other day, a Kiwi guy I've worked with. Mm. He's going to do a whole season next year, I think. And he'll have the ovals. That'll be interesting for him.
Yeah. Is it quite a difficult thing to transition one way or the other? You know, you've done a lot of normal European racing, and then you try some oval stuff, or you've done a lot of oval.
You can't rely on car control or anything like that. You know, you got to keep it with still, if you can, a tiny bit of push. You get a bit of neutral, you think, just get the front end a little bit better, it'll spin straight away. And they're soft. The cars, I mean, like I'm talking 30 years ago, maybe more. But if you would look at Dale Earnhardt going along senior at that point, and you'd see the wheels on the car side on, you know? So you're driving these huge, basically 1957 Ford Fairlands with modern body on, and over here you'd be putting springs on racing cars, 700 pounds, 800 pounds, and they were like 350-pound springs, and 1 pound, I thought, well, gosh, it should be stiffer than that. So we tried stiffening it up, but it just goes past the tire. It would not do it.
Right.
So although they look, and they'll probably be a lot better now, they look quite stable. They're sitting in them, they're moving around.
Really?
A lot.
Wow. Yeah.
And there were no mirrors on the side in those days because they get knocked off. So you didn't have side mirrors. You had one in the middle.
Did you get like a wide one?
It looked wide when you're sitting in the car. Didn't see that much when you were driving it. And then you have a spotter, a guy, you know, you see them.
Okay, yeah.
You look at the grandstands and there's a little thing on the top, you know, where there's about all the spotters sit. You can
right,
see it.
Okay.
Go high, go low, you know, the guy's there, someone, you know, and they wander around. But fantastic time. And also, they had all these little stickers on the side, on the guard. You know, little advertising things. I haven't really looked at one lately, but you'd have all of these, you know, about 30 little subsidiary sponsors. And if you made the top 15 in a race, they'd all send you $200.
Oh,
and so, you know, you'd come 15th in New Hampshire or Darlington, and then you come home, and then for about 2 weeks, all these little checks come
to nice.
Dear, and then stamped in Rob. It was a standard letter. You know, congratulations on your 12th on your
birthday,
and here's your check for $200 here. Yeah. There's a lot.
It's mental to think of them like moving around. What's the funnest? What series racing have you enjoyed? Did you think you enjoyed the most? Or were they all sort of a bit different?
They're all different. You enjoy the success. You know, if the car's painted on the road and you know, it's working really well, you beat people, I think that's what you enjoy. I don't know. Fun when you look back on it.
Okay, yeah.
you know, there's some maybe some races and things you'll talk with. You know, I talk with Stefan Johansson, who I race against a lot, you know, and there's, we have some good old talks because we've collided, I don't know how many times. And we laugh about it. No, you know, but at the time,
yeah,
you know, Ron Dennis was running him, and Ron was never very happy about that. Well, he wasn't very happy generally, but he was even less happy if Stefan bumped into me if I did it to him.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say that's not fun, because that's not being that kind to something that was very kind to me. You know, I had a living doing that for 40, still do, you know, and did beforehand, because I'd write for some car magazines and do interviews and things. This is when I'm 16, 17, that sort of stuff. So it gave you a life, and it was a completely classless life, you know, particularly coming from New Zealand, you know, and you'd go and sit and talk to Bruce McLaren, you know, you'd be a kid.
Yeah.
He'd get his autograph, he'd sit and talk to you and say, you know, get your arithmetic. Nice. We called it arithmetic then. Yeah. They call it maths now. You know, take care of the arithmetic. Phil Hill would come and do the Tasman Championship with Bruce and the Coopers. He stayed in touch with me to the day he died. You know, and I'm getting his autograph at 13. You know, and
that's so cool.
What a thoughtful guy. And then I trained his son, Derek. He won race at Goodwood. And I mean, this is 30, 40 years later. And he wrote letters and things like that. Now, these were, this is a privilege. You know, you're standing there at, getting an autograph. And then in the Tasman series would happen during our school holidays. You see, so you'd get little gopher jobs with the teams. And there would be Jim Clark, and there would be Graham Hill, and Colin Chapman was out there sometimes. And you'd sit beside them. But I was sitting there one day, a Thursday or Friday before the New Zealand Grand Prix at Pukekohe, just sitting and dangling my feet there. And you could sit right beside, there's Colin Chapman or whoever it was sitting there. And Graham Hill's Lotus 49T turns up. It's a brand new car. Adrian Newey owns it now. And it became a Lotus 49B thing that won Monaco.
Right.
And things. But, so this is January 1969. So Graham's just won the world title at the end of 68. And they're building a brand new car for the Tasman series, which was known as a 49T at that point for Tasman. And I'm sitting there dangling my feet. The car's right in front of me. And Graham walks across the track from the paddock, and the paddock area over there. There's nothing on the track. And he comes across, and there's immaculate overalls and a jacket and a Firestone stuff. And he used to look good, Graham.
Yeah.
And he comes to the car, and Graham was a good mechanic. And he started walking around the car. And he goes to the left rear, the right rear. And he's, I'm here. I move my knees because he comes here and goes around. And he probably spends, you know, 6-7 minutes just not talking to anyone, just looking at the car. It was quite a long time to be.
Yeah.
I've just arrived from England. I'm having a look. I come from the hotel. And then he called a mechanic over there saying, and I'm looking at it. He goes, who set this car up? And the mechanic said, oh, whoever it was back at the, And Graham pulled a notepad out of his jacket pocket and a pen, wrote his name down. He said, right, I'll have his job when we get back, you know. And I thought, God, you know, not so nice, Graham, because he was that nice, affable
thing about
him, you know. But, yeah, you get it later on, you know. But it was just a moment where I'm standing there thinking, I'll have his job. And they were interesting. He was a good mechanic though, Graham. And his mechanic was a friend of mine, became a friend of mine, did what they call engineering for me within a Formula 3. His name was Alan McCall. And he was Jimmy Clark's mechanic on the Lotus 49 and on the Tasman Series car prior to that and post that. So he's a Kiwi guy. And they were qualifying for the British Grand Prix in 1967. And they're going fine. They're in the front row, Jimmy and Graham in the Lotus 49s. Graham shunts his car. And so it has to go back to Hethel to get fixed overnight. And I think the race is on a Saturday in those days. So it's Friday. Meanwhile, there were no garages. You didn't have garages at the tracks in those days. So all the teams did deals with local dealerships.
Okay.
Dealership teams. Yeah, and they would... So Jimmy's car, or Lotus, had done a deal with a Ford dealer in Buckingham, right, down the road from Silverstone. So that car gets sent down with Alan McCall to prepare for the following day. The other one gets put on the trailer in a transit or something and drives off to Hethel. And Graham goes with it, because Graham's got all the notes about how to build the car.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah. So they spend all night, they build the car. It comes back. And they arrive back at the track, and they're sitting there, you know, it's, I don't know, whatever it is, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. And they've been sitting there for quite a while with Graham's car. And then somebody noticed, where's Jimmy's car? It's not here. And they'd forgotten it. And Alan was down at the Buckingham Garage. It was Saturday. There was no access to the office to make any telephone calls. And who would he have called anyway? Because... there were no mobile phones.
Right, yeah.
So they quickly realised what they'd done. They quickly got them out, tore down to Buckingham. There's Alan sitting on the front wheel of Jimmy's Lotus 49. You know, they'd totally forgotten him. And they drove it to the track. And he won the race. He won the British Grand Prix.
That was amazing.
I know, it's a funny story.
That is quite
and
funny.
And
so throughout this time that you were racing, were you sort of consciously... driving and sort of working on a driving sort of style or techniques and sort of like mentally trying, like logging and working on
only
that sort of stuff?
Possibly. Talk about this a little bit. I mean, let's go, you know, no. I think you just outdrove people.
Mm.
You just outdrove. You'd look at the, you'd pick the most dangerous corner. You'd think, this worries me. It's going to worry everyone else.
Yeah.
I look in the mirror. I didn't care if it was Nigel Mansell or Nelson Piquet. Oh, he was Piquet. You do that, you think, you know, and you you come to a chicane and you would ignore it, you know, and it didn't seem like racing at all, you know. And so no, and you would think so. We talk about this. So let's, if we go back to here, I am winning a race at Silverstone. I got Michele Alboreto or someone behind me, and everyone, some whoever's going to be the next Formula One
thing. Yeah.
You win it. You briefly hold a lap record, Silverstone Grand Prix. You get your super license. You know things, right? No, you don't. You think you know. And all you're doing is driving as fast as you can, learning how cars work. Very luckily, I had spent time with Ron Turanek, who was the Brabham route designer. And, so you'd learn how to make cars work within the framework that you had, and you'd go out and every now and then you'd win some races. The art and craft of driving, no. I think that came later when you have to have the best racing drivers in the world with you and the best engineers, work with the engineers as well. And you need to deliver. You need to be able to identify and articulate what the difference is.
Yeah.
And that makes you think. And so when, now I keep mentioning Ron Turanek, and I know you probably don't know, but he was one of the world's top designers.
Right.
Very practical. And he had the Ralph Honda Formula 2s, and I would test those for him sometimes. And Ron was a designer and a racing car builder. And then he also did a bit of racing with Jack, a bit of hill climbs and things, you know, years before. Fancies himself as a bit of a driver.
Mm.
So I suppose it was about, he's passed away now, Ron, but about 25 years ago, maybe more, but probably 25 years ago, he said, I want to come and do a day with you. You know, one of these days that you do with all of them.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll go and do it. So we drive up. We do the day and it's a great day and he learns, you know, does things, you know, I mean, not to be a racing driver. But we're driving back and he goes, are you a better driver now than you were 25, 30 years ago and you'd be testing my Formula 2s and I'm racing my Formula 3s and all that?
Yeah.
You know, are you better? You know, it's a very difficult question to answer, you know. But now I think it's just that I should have stopped 30 years ago, 40 years ago, doing this. But every day I'm out there. You're with the best drivers in the world, yeah. thinking, what about this instead of that? What about that? You know, and sometimes someone else may not even be a racing driver, but probably comes up with some phrase describing something.
Right.
And you think, why don't, that's better than the way I've been described. Yeah, well, why, you know, why have I never described it like that? And I think we've had 75 Formula One drivers go through, or more, since the 1980s.
It's quite a lot.
It's a lot. And, if, you know, a couple of world champions, if, not all of them, and then others. But I was adding it up the other day, or not the other day, but about a year ago.
Yeah.
We're saying, let's just fund, how many are there? We're saying, and then we got up to about 75, a bit more. It's a lot of drivers, you know, and that's just Formula One. That's not the Indies, that's the Indy drivers, that's not the Bathurst, the Aussie V8s, or the Formula 2s, or the rally drivers, the rest of them. So the sitting there with them, I'll do a couple of laps. I'll sort of do it. I'll sort of see it, you know. And the rest of the time I'm in the passenger seat. And it's all, yeah, good, what about this, and the other. It's a real, it's quite an intimate dialogue, like a hairdresser relationship. You know?
Yeah.
Except we've got a stopwatch. And we can feel it. And which makes it easy. We can feel it, but we can time it. And all during that period, you learn to identify things, to be able to articulate it, to be able to say, yeah, if we move like this, this happens to the car. And when you're doing it, yeah, you'll do it, you'll sort of do it, they'll sort of see it. What you're trying to do is get into their brain so that they give themselves their own examples. And it's that, and that could be 3 days in, that could be 10 laps in. I did this, I felt that, and there's the stopwatch. I got that. Right. And it builds another channel in the brain. It's not like listening to a song. Say, oh, it's a fantastic song. Someone else goes, well, I hate it, you know. Or this painting here is worth, you know, $5 million to me, you know. And someone else looks at it going, I don't see it at all. Now, if we aggrandize this slightly and say, well, it's a training exercise, but it's an art and a craft, you know, some guile and style and this, you know, and this arty thing, we're doing it. But we have a stopwatch. And that was what I found the first time I drove a racing car, which is a good one. First two laps, I'm going slow, and I timed it. Now, I'd been spent my life, we played in bands, you do things, you write things, and you play wonderfully, and everyone hates it, and you played great, and you played terribly, and they're always great. You know, the measuring stick isn't that great.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Around the track, and so I got to stop. I thought, this is simple. There's a simplicity to this. And because it's not often you get measured.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what does it, and that's what builds the chain, the channel in your brain, and it becomes something that you are, not just something that you do. And once you've given yourself your own examples, it's great. You take ownership of the idea, and it becomes fun stuff. It becomes obsessive, really. And lap and lap and lap and lap. There, you've done it. You know, yes, five laps later, you do it again, and you get the lap time. So that's what I do with them, mainly to transfer. But did we know that back in 1978?
Yeah.
I'd like to think you weren't completely ignorant, you know. And of course you've got to know things, but I suppose you've got to know to get around the corner, you know, and so on. But you know, it's not all just like the lines or anything like that, you know. It's something, it's you becoming at one with the car, becoming at one with the surface, and you can just transcend the car and become at one with the surface. You know, it's a nice feeling. That's why they'll come in for one day from the US or Australia or something, and they'll come back again a few months later. You know, there might be just two things you do in Indy, or there might be a dozen things you do in a rally.
Yeah, so if you've got someone coming in who's a Formula One world champion, by most people's standards, they're very good at driving and very quick. What sort of things do you then work on with someone like that? Because you go, well, from my side, I go, well, they're really bloody quick.
What are you going to tell this person?
What are you going to tell this person? And how do you go about that? How do you approach it?
Well, you don't know anything to start with.
Yeah.
Because they drive the car and you think, hang on, that was a bit lumpy. You know, we're coming off the brake a bit suddenly, aren't we? You know, yeah, sure, it's got a higher minimum speed, but look at the light. I don't know what they're going to do wrong. Yeah. You know, everyone has a tendency, some people turn late and sharp, some people, you know, sit on the ideal geometric line, you know, and that, of course, loads the car up a bit too much, for too long sometimes. And so the people who will get stuck with that.
That little point there, I say that little point, I feel like that's quite a big one. When everyone goes to their first track day or whatever, we all see this sweeping curves that go around a corner and they say that's the fastest way around. Talk to me about this.
Well, is it?
I guess that's the question, is it? And then probably it depends.
Yeah, there was a point where when we used to run on car tyres that lasted forever, and you didn't get the tyre degradation, that you could have a long corner and even you could sometimes flick the cars and then hold a bit of a drift and they still kept going forward. You know? So it's the later you turn, the sharper you turn. The sharper you turn, the more you ask of the car. And so going for the ideal geometric line, you'll find halfway through some corners. I won't name any names, but you'll see. It spun. Oh, I'll have to wait to look at the data and see what happened. We know what happened. You know, you sat there for too long on the line. Whoops, too much load for too long. Whereas a little bit of rotation, you know, in the middle, just if you can, around 25% of the cases, you can get a little bit more of a turn in the middle of the corner. Not with your steering. You know, people think, God, what's that? But it can be sometimes, but the rate you've decreased the brake pressure, how long you've stayed on the throttle, how much throttle you did or didn't put down, there's a variety of ways of getting a little bit more rotation and maybe a bit more steering, perhaps. One of the least of the options. And so it's a bit more of a 50 pence piece.
Right.
Corner. And then maybe 25, 30% of that is other corners can be like that. It's the higher minimum speed, say, on your ideal swooping corner. Here's the turn and point. It's not a point. Yeah, the turn and point is, by the time you get there, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weight transfer region, and you're peripherally taking it. But more you're looking at where do I want to get to, which is your apex. Which is a bit like your truth. It's the point where normally where you're going the slowest and changing the direction the most, and it can move around a little. This is a geometric one, but I've got that rotation done, and then I'm taking steering out of it if I can, because of that higher minimum speed on the ideal geometric line. It gives you 2K more, 3K more in the middle of this corner. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's 2 or 3K faster down the following straight, because that extra 2K going around does put more load into the car, and so its rate of acceleration may not be quite as high. You know, if you've got 60% of the track is full throttle, right, be good if that was straight.
Yeah.
You know, if it's going around a corner, you know, it's only going to go that far.
Yeah, you're using up more traction on turning.
It's just only goes, it doesn't go quite as far. The ideal line, I wouldn't, sometimes, you know, sometimes if it's an easy flat corner. But you can miss the apex a little bit and still win. You know, don't put more steering on to get there if you've got room on the outside.
Right, yeah. So then I guess you're saying about tyre degradation, which, yeah, in a perfect world or in a sim, actually even sims take this into account now, your tyre would never run out and you can drive the same line or the same situation for the whole lap. But actually in a race, it's about the highest, your total race time needs to be, or your average lap speed across the whole race, average lap time needs to be the shortest. Mm-hmm. So you're managing less and less grip until you change tires or get to the end of the race. So then you're saying if you are straightening the car or accelerating more in a straight line and these sorts of things, you are degrading your tire less.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's a bit more of a high peak, say in the middle where you're rotating the most. But then the next 7 or 8 car lengths, right, it's a lot lighter on the car. So it's that little bit of a high peak it's a little more of a load there. That's like putting your hand on a red hot stove for a fraction of a second and it's gone.
Right.
A bit of damage, but it's gone. The other one, keep going around. It's like having the stove half as hot and keeping your hand on it for a few seconds.
Yeah.
It'll fry your hand. So it actually works out slightly in your favor to get the rotation and get the steering out of it. You know, because you start to feel that corner's gone on a bit too long, hasn't it? You know, and also it won't accelerate quite as quick. But not either equally, you can't go too slow when you're getting, you know, your rotation. You can't stop the car and get out and jack it up. Point it that way, get back in it. Sorry, because someone will drive around the outside of you. Yeah, you know, do it. So there's a compromise to it, you know. And so it's good, right idea, but a bit slow. Let's make that a bit quicker next lap. You know, that sort of thing.
And what car are people driving when they come see you?
Mostly a Ford Puma.
And why have you picked a Ford Puma?
You can talk.
Okay, yeah.
We don't wear helmets. You know, we're against the stopwatch, but, you know, the environment's good. They move a little bit. So there's a bit of a ripple effect from anything you've done. If you do it in a Ferrari 360 or something, it's over and done with.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you've got, the slower you're going.
Yeah, the more time you got to the, I did this and I feel that.
Yeah, I did a day at Bruntingthorpe with someone and we were in an MX-5 compared to driving like the Radical or something. You know, you can split the corner into just significantly more chunks because your brain can process it.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, you've got these Formula One drivers come in who are, you're not quite sure what's, I guess there's another element, which is they're all driving different cars. So there's a car element in F1, obviously. But then some drivers embarrass their teammates quite significantly, like Max at the moment. What do you think of Max's driving?
Oh, that's on the limit. He's absolutely brilliant. Just, you know, he's got it worked out. I think he's number one. And I think it's sort of like Max Lewis.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Maybe Alonso.
We've just been off for a little bit of a break and we started talking about racing and I was asking Rob about a crash I'd had at Spa. So that's what we're talking about when we come back.
What do you think? Do you think there should be something should be done about Eau Rouge at the moment?
No, I mean, I'm good friends with Lance and father and all that. Yeah, you don't want it to happen, but if you did something to stop that, you would also stop every oval, in America.
Yeah.
Or anything that's, anytime you find somebody that's lost it and then slightly unsighted, or the accident, when if you finally see it, you know, has happened and then you see it.
Yeah.
It won't just be Eau Rouge, it'd be a lot of corners like that. You know, you could have that at Goodwood. You know, somehow you come over around Ford Water and then somebody's lost it, which they do from time to time. But you don't know about it until you're just cresting. And what are you going to do? Somehow slow it down, you know, whilst you're leaning and doing this and so. So, no, they've made it a bit too easy for people. You know, you used to be a bit tougher. You know, if you went off, you were off the track.
Yeah.
You know, and they do have these, they build a car park on the outside of things.
Yeah.
People take chances, you know. I somehow think that any track where if you leave the track and there's a time advantage, there's a flaw in that design somewhere. You know,
yeah.
I think.
You should, like Monaco, you can't cut very much.
They don't seem to.
But the one bit you can cut, people do accidentally cut.
I know. So I don't think, it's a worrying corner, of course, as well. Yeah, because it's a worrying corner. But I don't think, I think you've got to keep that sort of thing in racing. But cars are so safe. Oh, sorry, I know people have accidents and they don't, but by and large, it's so much safer. You know, when Jacques Villeneuve had an accident at Eau Rouge because he tried to take it flat or something, in a BAR something, Honda. He then said, oh, it's the best accident I've ever had. I thought that was a... I didn't think that was a very impressive thing to say.
Yeah.
My best accident.
Yeah, what was your best accident? How are you ranking it?
Yeah. You know, he got away with it because the car was safe and he hit things in the right place and nobody else T-boned him. But they could have done.
Yeah, that's it. It's like the cars are great at dissipating energy. They're not that good at getting hit by another car.
No. They're very heavy now, cars as well, so they do go on a bit.
Yeah. Do you have to drive the modern, like, I don't know, current cars differently to how you would drive 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Do you have to drive them differently because they've evolved and they're different, or
well, you can't,
similar basics?
Similar basics, because it puts it well, yeah. You can't have the corner going to it. You can't be correcting slides. You just cook your tires. Doing that, you're supposed to give the lap up. Whereas there was a time where you could hold a bit of a drift, you know, and cars kept going forward. So you do have to be a bit more delicate, I think, you know, with the cars, because it used to be pole position when you get a bit of opposite luck and do that. Now you just give it up. You know, it's ruined its tires, or that won't be any good for the next lap, or it just isn't fast.
Yeah,
you know, they do that, but they don't go forward at the same time.
When you've got, before we had a little break, we started talking about Max. Let's say you've got someone driving to that level. Like, let's just say he's like pretty much on the limit the entire time. What does that feel like as a driver in a car like that? Is it, have you got a bit of scrub at the front, a bit of scrub at the back, or what? Yeah, what's he sort of feeling when he's driving like that? Because it looks so smooth.
It feels the beginnings of a tiny bit of understeer. You know, so he might ease off the throttle a little, you know, and then you feel the beginning of a little bit of tyre slip at the rear, and he might then ramp the throttle up on the next lap, or just a fraction slower. But he's operating on a very, very fine line of himself. He can feel, you know, the limit very, very easily. You know, it's a tiny, tiny little bit of movement. It's big. You can operate.
I like the concept of sort of like resolution, as in like when you first start driving, you've got like, I don't know, 6 blocks. And that's like you're turning, accelerating. That's all you can think about. And then as you learn a bit more, there might be, whatever, 24 things. Mm-hmm. And then there's like 1,000. And then when you get to like Max, it's like it's scaled up so much that do you think he is consciously concentrating on tiny, tiny things? Or he's at that point, it's all kind of in there and you're probably thinking about bigger things like,
I don't think he's concentrating on tiny little things. He'll be going absolutely flat out. But the tiniest little thing that happens as a result of that is going to be a major thing in his you know, I've got no front end.
Yeah. I've got no front end, like a tight, half a percent difference or something.
Yeah, that's right. And that will be different to me. Again, means I cannot take this corner absolutely flat, which no one else can, but I can if you'll just make the nose go in a little bit better.
Yeah.
You know, and that'll be, I can't drive.
Because you hear of cars that are easy, sort of easier to drive. I'm not saying F1 car. None of them, I'm sure, are easier to drive. And then you get cars that are not so easy to drive, but might be a bit faster. Does it generally, if a car is easy to drive, does it necessarily mean it's fast? Or is there any sort of metric of weighing those two things up?
I don't think really. I can remember KK Rosberg, Nico's father, saying, you know, they all feel terrible on the absolute limit, you know. I'm not sure that's the case because when cars really work, like when Jochen Rindt won, I think, the Dutch Grand Prix or a Grand Prix in the Lotus 72, one of the early ones he won. Maybe Hockenheim. He said to Colin Chapman, it was so easy, the monkey could have driven this car and it would have won, you know, because it was so easy. So I think when it's really, really nice, you're not really thinking about anything, that's probably the fastest. You can rag a car and it will be on the limit, and you can probably out someone like Rosberg, KK Ros, would outdrive people.
Yeah.
You know, do a better job at hanging on to that car and using the car control he had, and, you know, but like Gilles Villeneuve could do that. He said, well, that's the fastest way, that's what it's like at the limit. But then you would take an Alain Prost, you know, and these days I think a Lewis Hamilton, you know, who's got a very elegant style. And when that car works for him, he's very fast. You know, he's been actually out qualifying George a bit lately now.
Yeah.
You know, and he's got quite a jump over him. You know, and I think Lewis has got a nice progressive feel in doing it. And he wants a car that feels nice.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that, yeah, the car's on the ragged edge. They all feel on a limit and I'm constantly on the edge and I'm using up reactions and things like that. Yep, you can win races depending on who's running second. But if Alain Prost says, no, I want my car to feel like this, he'll probably cross the finish line. So anyway, being a faster racing driver, but he'll probably cross the finish line a bit sooner.
Yeah. And then the sort of the concept of the perfect lap, or you've got someone down and you're coaching them and you've got your course. In your head, I know you move around quite a bit now, and probably the course, maybe. Do you spend a lot of time on sort of set circuits now, or are you setting out your own courses?
No, Goodwood I do. That's set. Okay, that's been set since 1951.
Yeah.
They put the chicane in. The Donington I use is not the Donington track, but the old 1933-38 Formula One track.
Right.
I use that. Obviously, you're very familiar with that.
Very, very familiar, yeah.
So you've probably seen photographs of auto unions with their wheels in the air. That's still there.
Yeah.
And so I use a version of that, which is great. And it goes down really, it comes up. And the Hethel, been very nice. The Lotus Test Track near Snetterton. And Bedford, where there's two or three different tracks.
Yeah.
Or four.
And do you have, you've gone to Hethel, you've got your Puma. In your head, do you have a time that you're like, this really is the fastest someone could do? Or do you
there are fastest laps, yeah, that we time every lap. And so we know, you know, a bit like a Top Gear scorecard.
Yeah.
On that day, we did achieve a 1:13.1, but we seem to be on 14 now, 13.7. Yeah. And there's such a variation, really, because the temperature, car's got another 5 horsepower.
Yeah.
Because it's cooler, fuel levels down, and so on.
And if you're sitting in the passenger seat with someone and they do, you know, they do a lap, do you have quite a good inner sort of reading of, I think there's another half second. I think there's another tenth. I think like a second or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And when you get, we're talking about Max, but let's say Max or someone like Max, what's like a, would you be like, okay.
But he doesn't, Max isn't in.
No, but a driver.
Like a win Formula 1 race,
Are you looking for like a hundredth? Or you're like, nah, there's still like a couple of tenths.
Within that day, you'll give yourself examples of being 300 quicker or half a tenth quicker or a tenth quicker. No, you're not looking for that. Well, you are because it's there. You're seeing it at least.
Yeah.
The result. No, you're looking for the way that they drive.
Right, okay.
It's the way it's you the drive.
Sort of concept.
Yeah, yeah. And it so happens that when that way is done nicely, we get that lap time. It's a product of that. But no, you're looking, thinking, that's too sudden on the brakes. That's too much of a sudden decrease. That's no guide on the wheel. We're turning a bit late. The later you turn, the sharper you turn. You know, that's too much wheel movement. That holding the wheel too tight. You're telling the car what to do with a hammer. Bump, bump, bump. There'll be a resonance after that. So there's a certain rate that you inform the car what's coming. And you, when you master that, the lap time shows it. You know, and it shows it, and we can feel it. You know, you can't look at the squiggly lines and show them, because everyone's looking at squiggly lines going,
yeah.
I see this. But I've never heard a racing driver come in here saying, I see, I see oversteer, you know, I see.
Yeah.
So yeah, you feel it, you know, so there's a disconnect. And so we feel it. And of course it's digital telemetry, so it can never be 100% accurate. It's a great x-ray, but it's a series of blocks. You're built over a set. You know, remember when they, well, you don't because you're too young, but when they invented CDs for music.
Yeah.
You know, and they digitally remastered all the music.
Yeah.
So you'd get a Beatle era song or something, Crosby, Stills and Nash. And the note would just fade out analog, like we're talking.
Yeah.
But then they digitally remastered it. And if it didn't quite make the next railway sleeper underneath that line, it stopped. And and you could hear all the joins. And yeah, I remember Crosby, Stills and Nash taking out advertisements in the press saying, don't buy our digitally remastered CDs. We left air around there for a reason. Now, there's a bit grand, a little bit precious. But they're kind of right. And so now, if we're putting down some brake pressure and we're going, you know, sort of just a tiny, tiny introduction or weight transfer through the initial steering, or something, you know, and if that just goes from 1 to 1.49 on that straight stroke squiggly line, that line's still going to read one, you know, and then we just go, it's infinitesimal, not infinitesimal, fraction more, 200s more, we go from 1.49 to 1.51, it's going to read two.
Yeah.
And so we're saying, but what about 1.116 to 1.234? You know, it's not there. You know, it's not there. And if it was there, what does it mean? You know, so you need to feel it.
And are people trying to capture more of that in data?
Yeah. I'll tell you about that afterwards.
Okay. I'm interested to know. And then...
Yes.
Yeah, so you've got... You've also got these people coming in who I don't know whether they necessarily, each person's different. So you might get some people with a massive ego. Do most people, presumably some people get sent, some get sent to you and some people want to come, so they come with a slightly different aspect and they might go, well, actually, I'm not sure you're always faster. Do you get any of that and do you have to deal with that?
Yeah, I suppose some are sent, but I think it's usually by consent. Because there's so many people that have been there and engineers that, and there are, and my phone number's not anywhere.
It's impossible to find.
Yeah, and no email address. Nothing is out there. There's some things we do like that. Some people do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's fine. But I've never said that. So anyone that turns up is usually someone who knows someone, and they've found it there. So when they arrive, the success rate, the acceptance, is sort of a false 99%.
Right, yeah.
Because everyone that's there wants to be there, you know, or most of the people, or the team wants them to be there, or something, you know. But if I'd put something on it, taken out an advertisement on the side of a London bus, said, you know, come here and I'll make you, like, your lap, you know, Clapham Common in, you know, 30 seconds quicker, or something, you would just be that much better a driver.
Yeah.
You'd probably get a failure rate of, you know, of about 99%
because,
you know, they wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about or what it was. So so my happiness rating is high because everyone's the same. It's like saying, I really want a McDonald's hamburger. So you go to McDonald's hamburgers and you get your hot McDonald's hamburger. So we're 100% happy.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted one and they were closed and you end up with a Burger King, you know, Burger King would only be 30% happy.
Yeah.
They decided they want to come. So,
I think it's
a slightly false reading.
I remember when I first started looking into sort of driver coaching and stuff like that. And you'd come across the sort of different methods. You can go to a track day and then someone might sit with you for 20 minutes, or you can take your car, or you might go to an experience center or whatever, and you might be able to drive a Lamborghini or something. And then I started hearing about, I don't think I'd heard about you at this point, but someone else. And they were like, oh yeah, they do it in a similar sort of thing to the Puma or Scott in his MX-5 or something like that. And immediately, I think there was like an ego check that had to be done before you even considered it, because you go, well, I'm not driving a Ferrari, or I'm not driving my race car or whatever. And then I thought about it and was like, no, I think after doing a tiny bit of driving training, I realized there's a lot in this that is nothing to do with being in a fast car or whatever. It's like actually driving a slow car fast can be really hard.
Yeah,
and you learn a lot.
You get, if you do it in a 430 Ferrari or something, you know, and we've driven everything. I don't think we've missed anything or raced it or that something. But it's self-correcting, you know. It's boom, boom, it's done, and you know, it's all over and done with much too quickly. You know, we need to say, look, what's going on here? What's that? You know? And also with a manual gearbox and working your hands and feet, so you become bump sensitive. You know, so you know, I do this downshift with my paddle shift and my racing car, but it always jumps a little bit.
Yeah.
It's never that nice, you know. And so therefore, when you become bump sensitive, you get used to a seamless series of downshifts in a braking area. You think, if I have a bump at the start of that braking area, it's going to affect that entire braking area, you know, until I'm turning and going somewhere else. You know, so therefore, that bump, let's do our downshift a bit later. All right, you don't have the engine braking, but let's do it later so that when you get that jump, that the paddle shift, if it's not brilliant and most of them aren't, is not, if that bump only comes halfway through, leaving you only 50 meters that are affected rather than 100 meters because you did it at the start.
Yeah.
You might do that. And that might be because you become very, very bump sensitive. You know, do you stay, run on the curb coming out of the thing and jump off the end of it onto the grass? Do we put a bit more load in the car and not have that jump? You look at where telemetry can be quite useful, but where cars just get stalled, you know, by a jolt of this, any jolt stalls the car. You know, now, you may want to have to run on the curb and go over the bump because you can't, you don't want to hold the wheel that tight. You know, it's faster to do that.
Yeah.
You've got to say, well, is it faster to go boom? Right, we'll keep it over here in a little bit. But the bump sensitivity is very, very important, and it should offend you. One,
not interesting.
You, should offend you. And most of them, and with the karting drivers, a lot that have come out of, and they're in their first season of Formula or something, 4-3, GB, something. But they've been in karts since they're 8. It usually takes a 2 or 3 days to get the bumps out of them.
Right.
That bump, 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 bump. Because karting is different. I don't train people to... Well, I train some people who race karts, but they're on the cusp or they're in... They've got their F1 junior contract from the age of 5. and so they're going to be getting into these single-seaters racing cars. And very, very jumpy. They don't know what clutches are for. And oddly enough, I was in a car the other day, and I've done this a few times. They had an oil pressure gauge. They don't know what it is. What is that? Look, gosh, the oil temperature's got really hot. Now it's really cold. No. That's an oil pressure gauge. We used to live on that, you know, and those things. I've never seen one.
Yeah.
You know,
and nowadays everything's got digital displays. Yeah, I know, and you don't.
But I didn't. I
hadn't come across that.
Come across it. Just know, maybe 3 or 4 times. I said, what's that? You know, it's an oil pressure gauge. You know? so it's very strange. It's a bit like a friend of mine in New Zealand who has horses, and they would send some horses out from New York City that have to be then quarantined for a certain amount of time. And in the next field, there were cows. And these horses from New York City had never seen a cow. And they wouldn't go near the fence. It took them a month or something to steadily go over and finally start to talk to a cow because it didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
So I'm finding that with oil pressure gauges at the moment.
That's quite funny. I was watching I was listening to a podcast or something, and this clip came up in my head, and I wanted to ask you about it. It's the clip of Senna driving, not sure what he was driving, an F1 car, and he's like blipping this throttle around the corner. You've probably been asked about this like 100 million times. What's going on? Is it bullshit? Is it real? What's the chat?
He is one of those booms that's going to be the one where he can get going, you know. But I talked with Jackie Stewart about this and saying why, and he's saying, yeah, that's one of his least attractive driving traits. Bum, 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 whereas Prost would be this. Now, how much that was, it would have been doing something, but the person to talk to there, I reckon, would be Neil Trundle down at McLaren. And he was Ron Dennis's partner, Rondell. Mm. And then when they moved into the thing, Ron dominated everything. And so, but Neil's still there. And and I knew Neil well back in the 70s and the 80s. They had a Formula 2 team there. They had the F2 team, Rondell. And then they have moved to McLaren. And he may know. Now, I've got a funny feeling, but I can be front, that they had a very long throttle throw in that car. I can remember...
Okay,
back,
so it's not doing that much.
As much as possible. But Neil would know that.
Yeah.
So Neil Trundle, his name is. He'd be through McLaren, and you can learn a lot from Neil. He's still, and I think when they had the Can-Am McLaren M8s and things like that, again, he'll say, no, you're wrong. But I don't know. He may not. And I think they had a really long throttle throw on those cars so that
you could just was ramped feed up. In, yeah.
So I'm not sure... what it will have been doing something, you know, whether it had as much effect as him, but just you know, he didn't win the world championship 3 times by doing that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Not everywhere, but he could deal with it. You know, it was a bit ugly.
Yeah, it's one of those clips that you see and gets cycled around, you know, and people.
So go, yeah, why aren't we all doing this?
Why are we not all doing this?
Yeah, No, I think Jackie Stewart put it right. It was one of his least attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. When you hear of a team, I say F1 now, of Red Bull or Mercedes, we hear there's sort of, I don't know, some chat going around saying that the car's designed for Max, for example. Do you think there's much, like, driver style and cars being designed for one driver versus another driver, making it quicker and not quicker? Do you have any thoughts on...
Well, I'm sure Max will have said, I want this nose to go in.
Yeah.
I just wanted it. You know? And that may be a bit too sudden for Perez. You know, but you could still do things in a car, you know, to dumb it down a little bit, to make it a bit lazier going in. However, it may not be quite as quick. But, they'll probably go with what Max wants, and Max definitely seems to like the nose to go in, and I'll deal with it myself.
Yeah.
Whereas Perez probably thinking, oh, I don't really want that. You know?
Yeah.
And so, but it makes it a bit slower. So, I'd say they'll be listening to Max. They'll be listening to Sergio as well to try and make
something
comfortable within that framework. Of course they will. But they'll be looking after the number one. Remember back when McLaren had James Hunt driving for them, and Jochen Mass was the teammate. And Jochen Mass came back from Germany. I've been there for a week with these fantastic new springs that they had some German manufacturer had come with. They were going to be lighter in the answer there. So he walked into the factory. Oh, I've got some springs for my car. And they just made you grab the springs in front. They're going straight onto James's car. You know? They didn't care about Jochen. So, teams do look after the ones that make their cars go fast.
That is brutal.
Yeah.
Slow corners or fast corners, and I know there's everywhere in between, harder to get right. Would you say one is more complicated than the other?
Yeah, there's more things going on in a slow corner. You've got downshifts. You've got more brake pressure going on. So that's got to be done right. The rate of brake decrease is critical. You've got to know whether it's better just to get direction change with no throttle or whether 10% throttle is going to do it. 10% can be good, which won't necessarily accelerate the car, but it can stop it slowing down. Mm. But yes, there's more involved in slow corners. If you've got stability and you're reasonably brave, through you go. I can remember thinking, if this car was really frightening at one point, trying to get this corner flat, I thought, if I take this flat, I'll kill myself, I'll die. And a lap later, I was coming around, I thought, if I can't take it flat, life's not worth living. So I took it flat, and I lost it. But I didn't hit anything. I was meant to hit something. From that point, you bring it back half a percent, to 99.5%. But so I can still remember myself thinking that,
Wow.
And that was the days where, can you take this corner flat, And that was the measure of a racing driver, as distinct from someone who drove a racing car, plenty of people are in that category. So now, as you said before, it's not the end of the world maybe just get through that really, really, really fast corner because it's going to put a bottle. So it does leave a good percentage of the time in these Mickey Mouse slow corners that go so slow that the sponsors can read the side of the car. the crowd can be a bit closer to them.
Yeah. Do you have any, for the listeners out there, do you have any sort of like general things that you can sort of, general tips that you can sort of say to more like a bigger audience that's not specifically on driving smoothly, fast, on tracks or anything?
Well, firstly, always tell the car what's coming next. Don't surprise it. So therefore, whatever happens with a brake introduction, there should be a minuscule introduction. Tell the car what's coming, with the brakes. And then when it comes to the steering, always just a little guide, So it's really a matter of always telling the car what's coming next is the first thing you would say. And then when you're driving on the road, you're stuck behind a van. You can't see the car in front. You're relying on the brake lights of the car in front. So, because they'll come back just a little bit. And then you can often look at the guardrail on the right, because usually you're sitting behind it in the fast lane or in the overtaking lane.
Yeah.
And you can see some shadows as to what's in front of him,
Yeah.
And you can see two or three, because if the sunlight's right. So you're looking at that, he's not just going slow. He's got those cars in front. If you can see through the car in front of you, harder and harder with SUV.
Tints and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah, then always, you know, take note of the brake lights of a car, three or four car lengths in front of you. You know that the car, three car lengths in front, will finally get the message. He'll brake. The guy behind him will brake even harder. You get that concertina effect and the whole thing comes to a halt. But always look, you know, where you can, three or four car lengths.
Well, I normally wrap these up with five questions. Are you ready?
So there have been no questions so far?
Yeah, but these are some different ones.
This is the real one. Right?
Yeah. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
I do. It was a good lesson. Oh, yeah, I had some great journeys, you know, through Death Valley and going to sleep at, you know, leaving Las Vegas. I had to be in California. This is Willow Springs and dozing off. I thought I'll drive through the night, you know, and finish testing in Vegas. And I'd get about, I don't know, 30 miles into the desert highway there. Stop, go to sleep. And I wake up about 8 hours later or 7 hours later with the engine still running and now I'm virtually out of gas. Okay. But I used to go down to Navarra, which is just north of Milan, have their Formula 3 engines. I used to go down sometimes with Stefan Johansson. We'd go down together. Or we'd be there at the same time. I'd play tiddlywinks. Or we waited for engines to be rebuilt. I got there one day and I had an Alfetta saloon, the engine in the boot. And I proudly told this guy at Pedrazzani's Nova Motor, who built the Formula 3 engines, Alphas and all that stuff. I drove all the way from Calais to virtually Milan, and not one car overtook me except a man in a Citroen DS21. And he said, this is back in the days when cars were different. Some cars were cruisers, some cars were, you know, you could zap up there, but they ran out of breath. And yeah, they had personalities, character styles. And he said to me, it doesn't matter where you go. It doesn't, you know what's coming here. It doesn't matter what you're driving. It doesn't matter how fast you think you're going. Someone somewhere will always pass you in a Citroen. And these cars still stayed different for a few years after that. And every now and then, you'd be going along, not thinking about anything, and you could see in England, so Citra would go.
It's always crazy fast.
Yeah, you just sort of raise a grin every time. Yeah, that's right. So that's stays with me.
Nice.
You know, yeah, the Citra.
If you could only drive one sports car for the rest of your life, what would it be?
For the rest of my life, it would be a Mazda MX-5.
Nice. And why?
Because it's an analog, pretty analog. There's not a lot of electronics between you and the surface. It's, and Ford don't make a sports car, otherwise it would be a Mustang. It's got a simplicity. It doesn't annoy people. You know, people wave
through.
They wave back at you. Mazda drivers wave to each other. You're going along, you have the hood down, you're going like 70, and it feels like it's going pretty fast.
It does.
You don't really go any faster. So you're not annoying people, and you'll sit behind someone, pull them, you know, a reasonable distance. But it's quite a therapeutic sports car. Would you call it a sports car?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mazda MX-5. And it could be an earlier one, a Mark III. I haven't driven one of the new ones. I suppose there is.
It's the same sort of thing,
isn't it? Okay. So I would say that until Ford build one, because they're my friends.
Okay.
And then I'll say, can we have something like that?
Yeah.
I don't know whether Jim Farley, who's the president of Ford, will do that. He'll be saying, what are you talking about?
Yeah, do you not want another crossover or whatever?
But a Mustang would be nice too.
Yeah.
But Mazda MX-5.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? Do you think something should be worth more?
Oh, are you talking classic sense? Are you talking?
Could be classics or new or, more like sort of pricing around. Is there something that you go, I think that seems cheap?
I'd like a Simca Vedette V8.
I have no idea what that is, but I will look it up.
I think it was about a 1963. Bit like a Mark II Zephyr style of car, Vauxhall, with a little 2.5 litre V8 in it. I think it was a Ford.
All right, yeah.
Fridge. And a friend of ours in New Zealand, who was a stock market man, had one as a company car. And I thought, a V8, I think it's the ultimate car. It won't be worth very much. Whether that's undervalued, it's probably not a good choice. It's the most undervalued car.
It's a really tricky question.
I do the MX-5 again.
Yeah.
Because you can pick them up for a few thousand quid.
And have so much fun. So much fun. Most interesting car to you at the moment? Could be from a technology point, could be, I don't know, just piqued your interest.
I think a Vassal Vega.
Ooh.
With a 6.3 litre Chrysler.
Nice.
I think that's an interesting car.
They're pretty cool. Yeah. You don't see them very often.
No, in fact, you virtually won't see one or not. I'll go back to cars that you just fell in love with, the early Mustangs, 64, 65 Mustangs. And these are great cars. But they had these coach buildery type companies, like Vassal Vega, French, and they bought these Chrysler engines. And I'm sure they were really dolled up and, made to feel very expensive that sort of stuff. And so I think just to look at.
Yeah, they are really cool looking things. Okay, final question. 5-car garage, unlimited value. What would you have?
Now, it always used to be the notchback Mustang, but the more I look at the 65, the more I look, I'm rather liking the 67 Mustang with a 302 5-litre V8 in it. It was just a little bit rakish.
Right.
Yeah, so 67 Mustang, hardtop is one. A Jaguar E-Type. 1961, probably, a 3.8. A Mark II Jaguar. Nice. Very similar vintage, same engine. Wire wheels on that. And a good cooling system. So there's three. The Mustang, the Jaguar, and that. What are the other two?
Have you got a sort of daily driver?
I don't drive one on the road, yeah.
You've got to drive one sort of day-to-day. It could be anything, but yeah.
The ST Puma?
Mm-hmm.
ST. It's fast, but a real rocket ship. I mean, you can pass things.
Yeah.
In it.
I've not driven one of them. Have you driven one?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Is it quite a fun car?
Yeah, and it's fast.
Nice.
And it's real tech dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, it surprises people. And so that's fourth.
And then you got one more. Would you have a track car, a race car, or anything like that?
No. Oh, well, a racing car to look at.
Yeah.
Not one that I wouldn't drive.
Yeah, yeah.
I might drive it slowly sometimes, but I'd have it immaculate. And that'll be the 1964 Formula One Cooper.
That wraps it up.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for taking the trouble.
It's been really nice.
Sorry if it didn't get too boring.
No, it's great. It's great. I loved every minute of it.
Good. All right. Well, that's super. Thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.